Good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brownell. Today, host Jeff Humphield talks with Rex Archer of the KCMO Health Department, Judy Sherry of the Missouri-Kansas Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and Lauren Statton of the Northeast Kansas Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Then, in the second half of our show, we will open the phone lines for your questions and comments. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Coming up next is Jeff and his guests.
Whenever there is an incident of gun violence that hits the national news, the debate on what to do about guns always heats up. The media talks to the pro-gun and the anti-gun forces, and all the rhetoric is thrown around again and again, along with a dollop of name-calling. While there are those on each side that would go to the extremes, everyone must carry a gun, or we must take all the guns away, there seems to be no middle ground, no call for sensible legislation, or a review of the effectiveness of current laws. However, there must be a middle ground, because polls show us that is where the vast majority of Americans stand on these issues. This is Jeff Humphield, and today we are not going to talk about constitutional rights or try to unravel that ball of twine. Instead, we are going to talk about the effect guns have on our society, why the evidence used to back the ongoing arguments is incomplete, and what some people are doing to bring what they think are sensible ideas to the table. Then, in the second half of our show, we're going to open the phone lines and take your comments and questions. Our guests today are Dr. Rex Archer, Director of the KCMO Health Department, Judy Sherry of the Missouri-Kansas Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and Lauren Statton of the Northeast Kansas Chapter of the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good
morning.
Dr. Archer, let's start with you. Like many of your colleagues in the health field, you have come to the conclusion that gun violence is a public health issue. Can you lay out what that stance is, why it's a public health issue, and what some of the factors are there?
Gun violence is actually a subset of overall violence, and violence is clearly a public health issue. We have a cultural challenge. If you think about an axis of justice, where on one hand people think about retribution and punishment, on the other side of that axis you think about contributive and restorative and distributive justice. In this country, we tend to focus on retribution and punishment. The other axis, the vertical one, is one of power and influence. Do we influence people through dialogue and nonviolent means, or do we use fear and violence and force to get our way? So those two axes interact, and unfortunately, most societies, the normalcy of society from Samaria through Egypt, through Rome, through the British Empire, through the American Empire, is in that bottom quadrant of punishment is the way you fix problems and you use violence and force and threat. If we were solving our problems by locking everybody up, we would have a safe society, and yet we lock up more people than anybody else in the world.
So in some ways what you're saying is that, you know, our move away from mental health services in the early 80s and stuff, and into pushing those folks into prison is part of the problem.
Well, it's part of it, but the mentally ill generally are less likely to actually commit violence and homicides. Now, some of your mass killings, people are more challenged there, but we're talking about day-to-day interaction between people where people are not civil, they don't know how to mediate disagreements and arguments, and things heat up. And the problem is that Our brains have what we call mirror neurons. We learn by imitating and watching. And you can see a couple of men walking along with their hands behind their back and a toddler behind them walking exactly like those two men. You can visualize that picture. Well, we do the same thing with violence. We see violence. The more that we see it, the more that we're likely to do it ourselves.
All right. We've seen in the U.S. Congress and even in some state legislatures efforts to block research into the causes and possible solutions to gun violence. What kind of data is available, and what more would you like to be, you know, see done in as far as research?
I mean, it is just amazing that we can do research on all other kinds of causes of illness and injury. But in this area, CDC is actually hamstrung so that they can't look at this kind of data effectively without fear of losing funds or potentially even losing their jobs. So, yeah, when a industry that is making money off of selling things to folks that then kill folks can have that kind of control over what we even know and how we do research, that's just, again, a symptom of the problem.
Okay. My understanding of what I've seen anyway, you have brought the health department into, you know, the on-the-ground efforts to deal with gun violence in our community. You know, what are some of the groups that you're partnering with, and what are some of the activities that the health department is involved with at this time?
Well, we partner with anyone who wants to reduce violence through civil discourse and mediation and looking at the various causes and risk factors for this. What we do know is that a large percentage of our homicides and violent acts are retributions or retaliations. So if somebody is shot or stabbed and they end up in the emergency room, we end up with a response team there that helps to reduce the chances that family and friends will then go off and retaliate for that issue. Once they start to calm down and realize that if they retaliate, the chances are that the other group isn't going to be wise enough to not retaliate also. They'll retaliate back, and they're actually now directly responsible for another one of their family or friends being killed. So you have to stop the cycle. And one of the challenges is there's a part of our brain called the amygdala, and this is there to get us geared up when we're being stressed. Back when there were tigers and animals that would attack us, we would get the adrenaline flowing. Well, unfortunately, in today's society, if you get that adrenaline flowing, it suppresses the frontal lobe, the part of the brain that then is more rational. So we have to be the frontal lobe for our friends when they become irritated and upset and calm them down. And a lot of the rhetoric around gun control is an example of that exact thing. People are getting upset and emotional and moving out of their logical part of their brain into their emotional side.
All right, I want to go a little bit different direction here and bring Judy and Lauren into this. And that is, the things that we see on the news and get a lot of play on the news are these mass shootings. And then just here in Kansas City, we have this young man that is admitting that he's killed a number of people, you know, like 15 or something rather or more. But there's a difference between the people that commit those crimes and what we see as kind of every day. Is there not? And what are those kind of differences? Rex, you want to try and address that, and we'll, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, for those that aren't here in the studio, we're all looking at each other trying to decide who's going to step in on the question first. But there's no question that most of our homicides, the vast majority, the ones that are taking the most lives, are those smaller one-to-one interactions between people. It can be domestic violence, it can be retaliation. It's because people haven't effectively learned how to get control of their emotions and behavior and to work out a problem without a violent reaction. Now, the more lethal the means that you have at your disposal, the more potential there is to take many lives. Single shot guns that might take 30 seconds to reload with our founding fathers are a very different issue than a machine gun or putting landmines in your front yard because you don't want the kids walking in through your yard. That's the kind of emotional way that we keep upping the ante where we need more lethality as opposed to more civil discourse.
All right, Lauren, I think you had something to say here.
Well, I think one of the things that really drives gun policy is these kinds of mass shootings, the things that get the most attention, and that drives us toward looking at solutions like just concentrating on mental health and so forth, and not looking at all these other things. There's, 60% of all gun deaths every year are suicides, and instead we're focused on concealed carry and open carry just about everywhere in order to tone down or reduce the number of these mass killings and so forth. But we're doing nothing to address these other problems, that with suicides and gun accidents and guns falling into the hands of other people, the kinds of laws that have been proven to work in a lot of areas, we don't talk about those. And we don't, certainly not in Kansas and Missouri, we don't. And so that's very unfortunate. And until we, start to focus on everything, we're not going to get very far.
You know, one of the things I was just getting ready to mention that you kind of stole my thunder here a little bit was that most of the gun deaths in the United States are actually suicide. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. So, that kind of means that if you have a gun in your house, you're more likely to have someone be successful at committing suicide, yourself included. I would think, is that kind of what the statistics kind of show? Or?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The statistics are amazing, where they say something like over 90% of suicides done with a firearm are successful, whereas about 12% if somebody does medicine or tries to stab themselves or cut themselves, it's huge. That's the major piece of it. If it's a gun, it's accessible. And suicide is most often an impulsive act. And if that firearm was not available at that moment, the moment might pass.
And not only are suicides higher in households where there are guns, and not just gun suicides, but just suicides in general in home households where there are guns for whatever reason.
Well, that's why it's prudent that if you are going to have guns, that you have the ammo and the gun separated and locked up separately, because who wants to come home, find out that there's a burglar in there who has effectively gotten your gun and now may use it against you? And although the statistics are harder to get, it used to be pretty clear back when we could get some of these statistics that the risk of a gun actually being used against you is much higher than that you will actually use the gun to defend yourself.
Once again, that goes back to the blocking of research and collecting this information. We got some smart people in our legislatures. And I'm going to go that direction at this moment. The Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence ranks state gun regulations every year. And for 2015, Missouri ranked 41st worst in the nation. And Kansas is stellar. They have the distinction of being rated number 50 on the worst gun regulations in the nation. Judy, Lauren, you want to tell us a little bit about your organizations and what you're trying to do in the legislatures?
Well, I will tell you what we can do as Grandparents Against Gun Violence. We are a 501c3, so we have to be careful about what we do. But educating, advocating, and participating are kind of the model that we use. So we have a very smart group of over 500 people are in our database. And our job is to let them know what legislation is being introduced and give it to them. Just give them that information and know that they will probably figure out for themselves what kind of action they should take. We do encourage our members to contact their legislators and to share that information with others. And as we enter an election year, we're telling people, be sure you know the stand of every person for whom you might be voting. And we encourage people to ask questions at any town hall they go to, anything like that. We had one experience where a group of people went to hear a school board town hall for people running for school board. And one of our members said, what is your stand on gun control? And the person said, I have never been asked that before. And until legislators know that we also have a voice, so far the only voice they hear with any magnitude is that of the NRA. And we believe that with 500 people, and we talked about who Rex might coordinate with, part of what Grandparents Against Gun Violence does is operate this Heartland Coalition Against Gun Violence with 36 co-sponsors. That represents about 10,000 people. If people begin to write to their legislators and let them know that we are not satisfied with the inaction on common sense gun laws and the action on absurd gun laws, they'll keep going with doing what they're doing. So it's our job to make our voices heard, and that's what we tell our members.
There's a saying, follow the money. And I think this is really important because you look at the weapons manufacturers that are making a product that they're then selling. Most of the money that the NRA has doesn't come from the contributions of its members. In fact, its members, when polled, they don't believe what the NRA proposes and how they manipulate people through those dollars, because it's the weapons manufacturers that are running things, and until we take that away from them, that's the real issue, is the control of money that's influencing policy, so that many of our elected officials are actually voting where the money's coming from, not voting what their constituents want.
Lauren, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Brady Group?
Well, for one thing, we do work closely with Judy's groups, grandparents, and the Heartland Coalition. One of the heartening things is that in the last two or three years, several groups have formed. We're also working with groups in Topeka and Wichita that have formed in the last year. So things are happening. We don't have the organization statewide and the money and so forth that the other side has, but there is this grassroots thing that is building out there. And our organization is different. We can work actively on against or for specific legislation, and so we've been doing that. We're in the midst of a session now, so we're busy. We don't work on the Missouri side, but a lot of the same things apply. One of the distressing things, it's always distressing when you're on our side of this issue in Kansas and Missouri, but since the Sandy Hook massacre in both Kansas and Missouri, the only kinds of gun policy that have been adopted in the state legislatures have been those pretty much having to do with expanded gun carrying. And again, like I said before, there's so many other different ways we could go, so many other things, approaches. As Dr. Archer said, a lot of things the public supports in large numbers, but it doesn't get anywhere. Expanded background checks being one of them. 40% of gun sales are not going through that process, and that means guns are falling into the hands of felons and people with dangerous mental illnesses and those kinds of things. So we're trying to do that. And and every year in the legislature, there's a new gun lobby wish list, and it pretty much gets approved intact. And whereas other practical, proven responsible and effective ideas from folks on our side and from people that aren't even allied with our groups, like the National Public Teachers Association and the American Bar Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, all of them have supported things like background checks and other things that we'd like to see adopted. But obviously it's a struggle, and we hope we can start to change that a little bit.
You know, I want to go back to the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence annual report. And in that report, the top 10 states with the strongest gun laws and the top 10 states with the lowest gun deaths per capita, seven of those states intersect or on both of those lists. So, you know, that kind of says, hey, these gun laws and some of these things that have been proposed do work. Now, I be truthful, they didn't give me a breakdown on the whole thing the other direction, so I don't know how, you know, what the correlation is with those states that have the worst gun laws. But once again, we're talking about research that's blocked at many levels by the money. So I guess my question is, when you give information like this to these legislators and to your members and all, what is the reaction? I mean, how do they treat you at the legislature when you go down to talk to these guys?
Well, they're always friendly and they listen, but they make it very clear that Kansas is a pro-gun state, and they say they come from, you know, pro-gun areas, and certainly some of them do. But when I try to make I was talking to one pretty influential legislator the other day, saying, well, you know, the over and over again, polls by unbiased groups show that there's 85% to 90% support for expanded background checks. So I said, I would guess in your district, there's probably a majority there too. And he said, oh, I think those are done by colleges and such. You can't trust that. And if you're making arguments to them about some of these things, they kind of lapse back into talking points. You know, well, you know, you're taking gun rights away from people. You're trying to punish law-abiding citizens, and you know, there's against the Second Amendment. And despite everything we say, we're not anti-gun. We're not trying to make it harder for law-abiding citizens to get guns or take them away. We're just trying to come up with what we consider, and I think most people consider, common sense answers and regulations that could make a difference.
You know, the irony is that fear is what seems to operate with everybody, and these people are fearful that we'll take that guns will protect them, and the reality is they don't. And there is some data that shows that people are more likely to be killed, 22 times more likely to be killed in their home when they have a gun. So some of the answers, as Lauren said, the talking points sometimes are really kind of nutty. And when you talk about fear, they're fearful that we will take their guns away. They don't seem to be fearful that there are people walking around who are dangerous, who are beyond domestic abusers. There are some people who are severely mentally ill at a particular time in place. And they can be fearful. They should also be supportive of wanting to have common sense, just background checks. If we would be very happy to see common sense background checks, expanded background checks to close that loophole of the 40% that are sold.
Dr. Archer, would you like to talk to the psychological nature of fear and on these legislators? Is it fear for their constituents, or is it maybe fear for their job?
You know what? I don't think any listener out there isn't aware of the influence that money has on campaigns and the challenges in this day and age of getting reelected if you don't have money. And when money is coming from it's really blood money that these gun manufacturers are putting into the system, and we're allowing that to influence our process when it's easier to get a gun than get registered to vote. I think we've got our priorities a little messed up. I mean, we know that there are places in the country where they have looked at, okay, if you have, if you're part of the system because of domestic violence issues, then probably you shouldn't have a gun. And when those are restricted, the deaths from domestic violence go way down. Yes, it's still possible to kill somebody without a gun, but it takes a lot longer usually, and there's more chance for the person to get away. There's more chance that noise or other things will occur and somebody else can interrupt the situation. So, you know, anything we can do that buys people time to get their emotions back under control and to use a different mechanism to resolve the conflict is useful.
That brings up an interesting fact, because one of the bills that was introduced last year by, on both sides of the state line, by Stacey Newman in Missouri and Barbara Beaulieu in Kansas, wanted a 72-hour waiting period, just a cool-down if somebody has been in a domestic violence incident, just having 72 hours to keep that person from being able to purchase a gun. That didn't, that never got a hearing.
Okay, I have to say that we have to take a break now. We have our calendar of events coming up and some public service announcements. When we come back, we will be opening the phone lines and we'll be listening to you.
This is the Jaws of Justice calendar for February 15th, 2016. The KC chapter of Mothers in Charge Healing Support Group will meet Thursday, February 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124, West 3200 Wayne Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. This group is for people who have lost loved ones to murder and violence. The first hour will be sharing of experiences, and in the second hour, therapists and others who can help navigate the emotional terrain will be available. For more information, you can find them on the web at kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. The Writer's Place and the Johnson County Library will present a reading sponsored by the Arts in Prison Incorporated of poetry by inmates and former inmates incarcerated at Lansing Prison. This event will be held at 6 p.m. Tuesday, February 16th at the Johnson County Central Library, 9875 West 87th Street, Overland Park, Kansas. A reception will follow the reading and all are invited. For information, contact Arlen Byert. That's B-U-Y-E-R-T at arlen85@att.net or 913-909-2915. The Douglas County, Kansas prosecutor and former Jackson County, Missouri prosecutor Amy McGowan has been removed from a case in Douglas County after several acts of misconduct in various criminal cases. The Kansas City Freedom Project is looking to establish the persistent pattern. The Kansas City Freedom Project is looking to establish a persistent pattern of misconduct by Ms. McGowan. If you or a loved one was charged with a criminal offense in the 16th Circuit Court of Jackson County, Missouri, or in Douglas County, Kansas, in which Ms. Amy McGowan served as prosecutor, and you feel there were questionable actions by the prosecutor in the case, please call the complaint hotline at 816-844-3100 and leave your case details. All complaints will be turned over to the FBI Civil Rights Division for investigation. My name is Keith Brown Eel, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week on Jaws of Justice Radio, Jessica Thomas talks with Christian Tyron of the Fully Informed Jury Association, and LaTara Smith returns with more on wrongful convictions in Missouri and Kansas. We now return to our discussion on gun violence and open up the phone lines at 816-931-5534.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio. I'm Jeff Humfeld, and my guests today are Dr. Rex Archer, director of the KCMO Health Department, Judy Sherry of the Missouri-Kansas Grandparents Against Gun Violence, and Lauren Stanton of the Northeast Kansas chapter of the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence. We are talking, of course, about gun violence, what laws may be effective, what research on gun violence has been done, do we need to do more, and what new legislation might help? We are going to open the phone lines for your questions and comments. We ask that you be respectful of our guests and listeners and that you keep your comments brief and to the point so others have a chance to call in. That number is 816-931-5534. And I believe we actually have a call coming in. As we're doing that, you know, background checks are one of the big things, and I want to throw something out there that a friend of mine came up with. Instead of requiring the gun store to actually do the work, that it be put back on the citizen. In other words, that we have a card that you have to go and you have to have a deep background check done. You have to go to classes to make sure that you know how to operate your weapon properly and safely. You were given the information on how to store it and keep it safely and all. And that then once you have done all of that, you're issued a card that says, I am eligible to be a gun owner. Instead, and that way when if your you want to buy a gun from your neighbor or one of your relatives, you have that particular card. Also, if you go into a gun store, you have authorization, and your number that's on that card is put on the form and everything else. Is that an idea that folks think? Does that make sense?
I think anything that involves improving training and education regarding gun use, that would be a really tough lift legislatively, I am sure. I'm not sure exactly what all the arguments would be because I think it's been argued before, but unfortunately we're kind of going in the other way. In Kansas, they took away training for people who are going to conceal carry, and so I know in our state that'd be really tough.
I think the other piece of it is that without the background checks from a database, you are excluding information that is really important.
Well, this would include background check on you.
Who would
to get
do
that
it?
Card, the background check would have to be done.
Where would you go to get the background check?
Well, that would be either a federal or a state requirement.
Okay, we used to have that in Missouri. We had that up until 2007. And Johns Hopkins has done studies that show that getting rid of that has increased the homicide rate dramatically. That used to be done. You had to go to the sheriff.
Okay, we do have a caller on the line. Caller, would you give us your name and what part of town you're calling from, please?
Hi, Jeff. It's Rebecca. I'm calling from basically Crossroads District. I think one thing that might be helpful is to win the cultural battle. You know, I think so many times people who want stronger gun laws are so cautious. It's like begging for crumbs, you know, we certainly don't want to, you know, violate the Constitution or infringe on somebody's rights. You know, I think the comparison to the propaganda around smoking cigarettes and how, you know, hey, this will calm you down, this will make you feel good, this is the cool thing to do. I think guns have become cool in some groups, and to sort of say, you're being sold a bill of goods. I mean, they're like, you know, how many thousands, millions of guns? I mean, it's insane. And to call out that insanity, I think, as long as they are taking the high road, hey, we're the constitutional protectors, and we have a right to have these assault rifles, when all of that is ridiculous, logically. I think we have to attack the mentality.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
All right.
Anyone have a comment on?
I have one comment that I picked out from the many good things that you had to say, Rebecca. When we talk about rights that people have under the Second Amendment, I think often they forget that we also, as citizens, have rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and feeling safe. So when you get into the discussion of rights, there are clearly two sides, and we've only heard one.
Yeah, balancing this issue of health and risk is important, and without as much data as we'd like, it's more challenging. Years ago, you could start a car without having to have your foot on the brake. And unfortunately, a few kids learned how to do that. They could put the key in the ignition and the car could get started and it could be pulled out of the driveway. A few people got hurt. So it became the law that you had to have the brake pressed down at the same time that you tried to start the car. Well, we could do that with guns. Guns could be designed, the technology is there now, so that only the owners or people that were authorized could actually fire the gun, that it would require a fingerprint identification to actually do it. We have an increased number of deaths occurring over the last decade or so, it continues to increase, of kids unintentionally killing each other with guns because these devices are not protected and the kids aren't protected from their use. If the gun manufacturers were actually liable for these incidents and had to pay for them, but they have a loophole there, they get out of that responsibility and liability. So, yeah, we could fix some of these things.
All right. We do have another caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
You talking to me, Jeff?
Yes, I am.
Oh, Michael is my name. I'm calling from Kansas City. I was hoping your guest could comment on the misinformation and essentially right-wing propaganda that goes out on the AM radio stations, probably 10,000 of them across the country, that fuel the fears and the apprehensions of so many of the supporters of NRA. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Okie doke. Thank you, Michael. Anyone want to talk about the what would you call it, the fear machine?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what all they're saying on talk radio, but what I hear, the common arguments are, one, that we want to kill the Constitution, the Second Amendment, or that we want to take away people's guns, almost regardless of what kind of legislation is proposed or any proposal. It's an act. It's the first step toward going down the slippery slope of just taking everybody's guns away. And that's an automatic response. When President Obama came out with his initiatives, that was quickly what the presidential candidates, certainly on the Republican side, were saying, this goes against the Constitution, which it does not, and that it is just a step toward taking away guns. So I don't know how you counter that. A misleading bit of information that is fostered by the gun lobby, and it is just a steady drumbeat of it. So it's not true.
I'll do my Pollyanna thing and say that our job is just to keep putting out the correct information, talking about the fact that there are more guns than people in this country right now. So the thought of taking away everybody's guns is absurd. We need to keep the information flowing. But sadly, one of the things I keep reading now is, and I will just say, that members of one particular party seem to not be concerned by facts. They don't. They even when it, confronted by this was said by a candidate, this is absolutely categorically not true, doesn't make any difference. So people talk all the time about now how we are in kind of our silos. We listen to and read and watch things that keep feeding what we believe. But our job is to just keep getting the information out.
By the way, I did say I don't listen to talk radio. I listen to you guys. I listen to
Well, there's talk radio, and then there's talk radio.
Then there's that other talk right. radio. Yeah.
Right. Dr. Archer, you...
Fear-mongering is a real challenge. It's well known that you unfortunately can and are able to manipulate people by the use of fear. And probably the most important thing that we need to do as a country is to learn how to manage our fear more effectively, how to support each other and have dialogue. And, you know, when we see others as different from us, then it's easy to get into rhetorical violence and then to physical violence. And fear is a way that we're manipulated, unfortunately, all the time.
Okay, we do have more callers on the line. So which caller? Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town are you from?
My name is Keith. I'm calling from Midtown.
Okay, Keith, how are you?
Fine. I would like to know what your guests would think about pressure being put on law enforcement officials to try to retrieve firearms that are involved in crimes by way of plea bargains with the people who have been convicted of committing the crimes. If you leave the guns out on the street after the crime has been committed, those guns can fall into the hands of other people who will still continue to commit crimes. And it seems like law enforcement officials are only concerned trying to prosecute people and put them in jail rather than trying to get the gun that was responsible for the crime being committed.
Anybody got a... I mean, the question is, yeah. You know, you have someone that's behind bars right. and they have a weapon out there. Somebody's holding it for them. And trying to get that gun mm-hmm. off of the street by, you know... you know, maybe placing them in a prison closer to home or you know, whatever that particular,
Yeah, I guess I wasn't aware that was a problem. I'm kind of assuming that if somebody's arrested for a gun crime, that the gun police take the gun away from that individual, or take it out of that household, but maybe not. I'm just not sure.
Well, I think what happens too often is people that are habitual criminals and do commit crimes, they don't keep those guns in their house. They have somewhere else that they have them stashed. And,
yeah.
and the idea yeah. is, hey, we can get that gun off the street because it may be a weapon that's being used by more than one person to commit crimes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in all kinds of ways, we need to get guns out of the hands of criminals. That's what background checks are about. That's what, as Dr. Archer was saying, having your guns locked up at home. There's like 200 and some thousand guns stolen every year, and the vast majority of those end up in the hands of people you don't want to have guns. So I think police and legislators need to do all they can to make sure that that's not so easy, that we get those hands out of the guns out of the wrong hands.
Dr. Archer, did it look like maybe you had something you wanted to say, or you're still mulling it over?
well, I'm not sure that it directly relates to the question at hand, but I mean, you did mention this issue of locking up the guns, and they really, you should have the ammo and the guns locked up in different parts of mm-hmm. the house. The problem is that somebody gets woken up in the middle of the night, and it turns out that it's actually another family member that got up and is stirring around. And you need more time to fully wake up before you can get a loaded gun. And so by having guns and ammo locked up in different parts of the house, it takes much longer before you can put those two together. And hopefully by then you've discovered that it was actually your grandkid that was staying over that's walking around, not somebody breaking in.
Okay. We want to remind everyone the number is 816-931-4100. 516-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. And I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your name and what part of town are you calling from, please?
Yes, Joanne from South Kansas City. It seems to me that our country is really in such a mess, it's really time to consider how England got along with the police just having billy clubs. I mean, because everybody's, I mean, I would be just as afraid of a policeman, I believe, as anybody else. You know, so I think we're in really bad shape. And then the other thing is, I really think that if the churches really, really got serious, churches could change things. There are enough people going to churches that if they really, really concentrated and worked, we could get this country turned around in the right direction.
Well, thank you for your call, and we're going to have our folks comment on this. You two groups, do you work within churches? Do you go to churches and talk to them? How do you approach?
Yeah, Grandparents Against Gun Violence definitely will go to any church that asks us. In fact, we are reaching out now to make ourselves available. But as we mentioned before, with the Heartland Coalition Against Gun Violence, we have probably 10 faith organizations as part of that group. And I agree that if more people just have to hear the facts and the information, and churches certainly are a wonderful way to begin. And it's sometimes easier to access a church, for instance, than schools. When you try to go into schools to talk about just gun safety, just how you keep your own home safe, most school districts won't even touch it. So churches are a wonderful way to begin to get that information out.
There are a lot of congregations out there that are starting to look at this range of justice issues, and it could be synagogues, they can be mosques, they can be Buddhist temples, Catholic parishes. There's a whole range of them. A couple of organizations, CCO, Communities Creating Opportunity, and Moore Squared, Metropolitan Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, are working on some of the things that add to the background of violence. You can still deal with violence without fixing all the other societal ills, but when you start looking at, are people able to make a living wage? Is our education system working the way that it should? Have we dealt with our racial segregation challenges and the redlining and blockbusting and other things that have created a lot of our tension in our community? All that really needs to be discussed as part of fixing and healing our culture, of which the gun violence is one of the symptoms.
All right. We do have another caller on the line. Caller, your name and what part of town you're calling from, please.
Yes, this is Angel from Kansas City, Kansas. I was just calling in because I have a friend that just shot somebody, and he did everything he was supposed to do. He turned his gun into the police and everything, but the guy that he had killed had tried to come at him, and he had two guns on him, but there's so many drug addicts that hang around those people that they take the other person's gun, like you were saying, that one gun is used between multiple people to commit crimes, and the police need to do a better job of investigating stuff like that.
Yes, thank you for your call. You know, that is one of the problems, is that those guns are used by more than one person quite often. You know, sometimes they're traded for drugs, or they're traded for other things. But overall, one of the things that we've seen is that crime in general has been trending down for quite some time, for like 30 years or something or other. Now that doesn't mean that there aren't spikes or whatever. But anyway, we thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you for letting me call in.
That's all right. And I believe we have another caller online also. Caller, your name and maybe not. Not quite.
No, I was going to say that homicides are gun violence may be down, but domestic violence abuse is way up. And that's what we've seen in increasing crime rates, even in Kansas City, that more of those are a result of domestic violence. And once again, when there is a gun in the home and there's an argument, it's just too simple to be able to settle that conflict in the wrong way.
And this trauma affects us all. When you have a friend or a loved one that either commits one of these acts of violence or has the violence committed on them, it harms us individually, and we have to work through a healing process. And there are groups out there that are available to do that, and I really encourage anyone that is experiencing the various parts of violence to work with others to heal, because this if you don't address this, then the risk that you can act violently and be part of that goes way up. It's paradoxical, but if you were abused as a child, you're more likely to abuse your own children, even though you know how painful that is, if you don't get help and go through a healing process.
We do have a caller on the line, and this will have to be our last call because we are running out of time. So, caller, your name and what part of town you're calling from.
My name is Rich. I'm calling from Johnson County.
Okay.
I wondered, considering the real possibility that marijuana will be legalized in Missouri, will that do much to reduce gun violence in the city? And I'll leave it to you to answer that.
Well, part of our violence is our inappropriate incarceration rates of certain populations. And so sometimes taking nonviolent crime and then putting people into a prison system with other people that are violent is actually spreading the disease. To use a contagious disease or infectious disease parallel back, hundreds and thousands of years ago before we understood how various communicable diseases were spread, we would lock people up and then the disease would spread in those confined areas and then come out of that system. So, I think we have to think about alternatives to incarceration and different ways to create restoration and have people be able to heal and give back to their community than just serving time where you're then exposed to folks that are also violent.
Well, we have run out of time, but I do want to give Judy and Lauren a chance to tell people how to contact their groups. And Judy, or
okay, I'll give you our website is www.mokans, that's MOKSGAGV.org. That's www.mokansgagv.org. It's a mouthful.
We don't have a website, but if somebody wants to contact us with a question or inquiry, just use our email. It's an acronym for Northeast Kansas Brady, NEKS Brady at gmail.com.
Okay. Do either or your groups have like Facebook pages or?
Yes.
Also.
Yes.
Just Northeast Kansas Brady group
right.
Probably find you.
Yeah. And we have Grandparents Against Gun Violence also has a Facebook page with that very name.
And at the health department, Aim for Peace, our phone number for folks that want to volunteer or get more information is 816-352-3069. You can also go onto the kcmo.org website/aimforpeace to get access to information on violence prevention.
Okay. We want to thank all of our guests for being here today. Up next is the 420 Drug War News. And
it's the 420 Drug War News, the following courtesy of the Cato Institute.
While legalizing marijuana as a matter of federal law would take an act of Congress, President Obama can decriminalize it. He can do this by moving it out of Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, which is reserved for substances that have no medical purpose and have a high potential of abuse, and therefore have high criminal penalties attached to their mere possession. Virtually all marijuana-related arrests are handled by state and local law enforcement. The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, simply lacks the resources to enforce the federal ban across all 50 states. That's why the Justice Department decided not to fight the legalization of marijuana in the handful of states that have taken that step. President Obama, without rewriting any laws or stepping outside his constitutional authority, can direct the Attorney General to start the process of reclassifying marijuana as a Schedule 4 or 5 substance, or declassifying it altogether. Reclassifying marijuana as a Schedule 3 substance or lower would have significant benefits for the budding marijuana industry and individual users. For example, the Internal Revenue Code prohibits the deduction of business expenses that relate to Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 trafficking. The Gun Control Act of 1968 prevents the sale of ammunition and firearms to the unlawful users of any controlled substance. A conviction for possessing a controlled substance can bar students from getting loans, and the rules are even stricter for public housing. Declassifying marijuana would solve all of these problems, but even merely reclassifying it would make it easier for legal businesses to access the full economy and reduce violent crime. Marijuana deregulation sits squarely within the control of the executive. The president should use his executive powers to allow for intelligent enforcement of drug policy without eroding the rule of law.
Give me an H! Give me an E! Give me an R-O-I-N! What's that spell? Heroin!
Started at a party, everyone was there. She had a couple pills on a little dare. But now she's missing class, and she's dropping her pom-poms. Nobody knows where she is, not even her mom. Everybody thought she was the all-American girl. So there goes the books, it's all about the score. There goes the doggy, life is such a bore. There goes the family, she's got a new friend. There goes the looks, this is the end. I guess she really was the all American girl.
Pick up heroin and you'll throw away everything you love. Share your stories on Instagram with hashtag heroin.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.